Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines whether economies succeed and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt, and is president of the Public Banking Institute. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments in the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. There are a couple of interesting developments in the news that I wanted to discuss before getting to our even more interesting interviewees. The first is a discussion that's going on in England. It was started when, in March of this year, the Bank of England came out with its quarterly bulletin in which it said that, contrary to popular belief, banks do not actually lend the money of their depositors. What they lend is bank credit created on their books. Banks actually create the money they lend. So Martin Wolf then came out with an article in the Financial Times saying, well, banks haven't done a great job of this money creation, or they haven't managed it particularly responsibly. So maybe we should be taking that power back and giving it to the government itself. This is something that's been proposed for close to 100 years, going back to Irving Fisher. It's called the 100% reserve solution, or full reserve banking. So then Paul Krugman weighed in and said, well, that was an interesting idea, but he thought that Wolf was overlooking the fact that it wasn't actually a bank run that caused the collapse in 2008. It was a run on the shadow banking system, the money market, and that if banks were prevented from creating credit on their books, it would just drive the business further into the shadows, into the shadow banking system, which is unregulated and is even more dangerous than the conventional system. Anne Pettifer weighed in England and said that the reason she disagreed with this proposal was that it would cut off the creation of credit, and that we particularly needed credit creation at a time when we're in a recession, as we are right now. And another commentator whose ideas I like a lot are Professor Richard Werner, who is from Germany. He wasn't particularly addressing Martin Wolf's proposal, but he was just talking generally about money creation by banks in a recent video. And he said that we don't need to take the power to create money away from the banks, that banks are probably where credit creation should happen, but that you need to regulate the banks, and that we have the most efficient models we have are the Asian model and the German model. So the Asian model, that would be Japan, China, and Korea particularly, have what's called credit guidance. Most of their banks are publicly owned banks, and so they require their banks to create credit, but they require that it be done for supporting local industry and the local economy. They aren't allowed to do it for speculative purposes, meaning money making money, which doesn't actually produce things, but just creates bubbles and creates profits for the money makers. And then the German system is a little different, but it has the same result. They have 70% of their banks are local banks. These are community banks, credit unions, publicly owned banks, and savings banks. And they have a mandate to keep their lending in the local community and to support the local community. So again, they can't speculate. It's the big banks that do the speculating, but these local community banks work to support the local economy. And that works very well. The other interesting thing that I wanted to talk about is Governor Jerry Brown's push for a constitutional amendment that would require that any excess money that the state gets over its budget, which of course they've been very frugal with their budgets in order to balance their budgets, anything they get over that can't be spent on the things that the state really needs, but must be put into a rainy day fund. They just have to sock it away, take it off the table, and put it into this rainy day fund, which would be for the purpose of being ready for the next big bank collapse or for paying down debt. So this is a very unsatisfying result. It was the big banks that caused our economic straits in the first place. We had to pay off the banks, bail them out, and pay huge interest and fees and interest rates, swaps, etc., things largely proven to be fraudulent. Huge amounts of money are going to Wall Street, and in order to balance the books while paying off Wall Street, we've had California slash services. sold off public assets, raised sales taxes. And Jerry Brown's pointing out that that sales tax raise was only temporary. Of course, that hurts the poor more than anybody else because they spend a much larger proportion of their income on consumer goods. So that's only going to last, I think, for another 7 years, and then we're going to be back where we were. And so that's why he's saying we have to save all this money. But it's a very unsatisfying result. So a much better way to do it is to take that excess money and put it in our own state-owned bank. Then we can have our cake and eat it too. You don't see banks keeping big rainy day funds. But all state and local governments do keep these big rainy day funds. And the reason is that they don't have instant credit lines. They don't have a cheap way to get money. And they're afraid of running out of money halfway through the year before they can do another tax levy. But banks have virtually free credit lines with each other. So if we took our revenues or some of our massive rainy day funds that we already have all around the state, Clint Richardson added up $600 billion looking into the comprehensive annual financial reports of the state and local governments in California. Huge sums that can't be spent, but they could be invested. So if we took a bit of that money, invested it as the capital in a state-owned bank, and then put all the state's revenues and ran the payroll through it, etc., we would have a huge capital and deposit base for a very large bank, which could then provide interest-free credit to the state should it go over budget. But meanwhile, it could lend its money. The revenues would still be there as deposits, but it could lend its money, creating credit on its books, just as all banks do, and have interest-free credit for its own purposes, for all that infrastructure we need, for loans to rebuilding the schools, maybe slashing tuition, maybe slashing sales taxes, some of those things that really need to be done. We can have the money for that if we create our own credit engine and break away from Wall Street, which is a giant parasite on our ability to be economically sovereign. So today, I'll be talking about that, among other things, with Laura Wells, who I'll be speaking to shortly. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Laura Wells, who is an expert on the California political scene. She was the Green Party candidate for governor in 2010. Before that, she ran as the Green Party candidate for controller in 2002 when she got more than 400,000 votes, the most votes ever for a Green Party candidate in a statewide partisan race in California. She's now running for controller again as a Green, and I'm running for treasurer, and we're both running on a state bank platform. So we're buds, but it's an uphill battle, as Laura can tell you. But first, we want to talk about the governor's push for a constitutional amendment that would require any surplus tax money to go into a rainy day fund to prepare for the next Wall Street banking crisis and pay down debt, rather than to restore those services that were slashed in order to balance the budget after the last crisis. Wall Street always gets paid first. Greetings, Laura.
Well, hello, Ellen. Great to talk with you.
Okay. People always ask me, how is your race going? I don't know what that means, but how is your race going?
Well, the thing that we have done, you and I, Ellen Brown for treasurer and Laura Wells for controller, which I'm calling the Rosie the Riveter team, we are on the ballot. We have Green Party designation, which means we're running with no corporate money, and we have ballot statements, and that will go to every voter in the state. And so when people ask how it's going, we've accomplished that, which is a huge thing. You mentioned that I ran for controller before, and the ballot statement was free. And now the capital city of Sacramento is charging us thousands of dollars. $25 a word ends up being thousands of dollars to put the ballot statement in, and the filing fees are higher and all of that. So we've done that. How's the campaign going? It's fine. We're on the ballot.
So what do you think of this constitutional amendment that Governor Brown is pushing that would make all the excess tax money go into a rainy day fund? Like, we can't spend it. It has to sit there for some further rainy day. One could argue that this is the rainy day. I just wonder what your views are on that.
It's another one of those ideas that Jerry Brown is an ace at wrapping up a piece of junk and making it look like a birthday present. The rainy day fund, where we take excess taxes and put it aside for a rainy day. It's just like you said, it is a rainy day. We don't have excess taxes. We have had cuts across the board in possibly every area that the state spends money on except for prisons. I just was listening to Richard Wolff's show, his economic update that I hear on Fridays on KPFA, the public radio here. North Dakota, amazingly enough, is the only state that out of the 50 that has not had an increase in tuition in public education, an increase in the amount of money that is paid for higher education by the tuition as opposed to by money that comes from the state. So North Dakota, with its public bank, and of course we'll talk more about that, has been able to keep higher education more available to citizens than the other 49 states that don't have the public banking. But California used to be a great state for higher education. I know, Ellen, you've talked about what it was for you to go to school and law school and what it would be now. And it's outrageous, and that's because tuition and other fees are a form of taxes. So that when they raise those fees, whether it's parking fees or park fees or traffic fees or college fees or any of those things, they are raising taxes on the very people that we should be providing services to, in other words, especially our young people. And they've lowered taxes on the super rich. And so now he's going to have a rainy day fund, and who's going to get the benefit from that money being pulled out of the state's coffers and stuck in some bank earning a small amount of interest?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that it protects the rich also, because when we do have the next crisis, their taxes won't necessarily be raised in order to cover it. I mean, they're the only people that can afford it. But if we have a rainy day fund, that money will get up, hit up first. So it's going to save the wealthy from the increase in taxes that we really should do. You mentioned about my tuition. When I went to Berkeley in the 60s, graduated in the 60s, tuition was free. I wasn't even sure. I remembered that, but I wasn't sure that I was right. So I looked it up, and there was a professor who did a graduation speech on that, and he said, when I tell students that tuition was free in the 1960s, they think that, you know, they think I'm imagining things. But he says it was, and it was because Jerry Brown's father, Pat Brown, was a New Deal idealist who believed in education and believed in supporting the economy. And so, you know, one of the things he thought was important was to support our young people so that they could get out there, get a good education, and then get a good job, and then they would be the hope of the economy, which they were. It worked very well. When I went to law school in the 70s, it was $700 a month. That's UCLA Law School, a state school, and I was an in-state student. In-state students now pay $45,000 a year just for tuition. I mean, it's unbelievable how anybody ever pays that off. I mean, they would have to get a job with a high-pressure law firm, and those jobs are hard to get.
They'd have to be corporate lawyers. Do you know, and that's one of the things that happens is that when our young people graduate from college, they have an average of I forget what Richard Wolff again said this, but it keeps going up every time I hear it. I can't even hang on to it. It's $10,000, $30,000, $45,000. I think $30,000 was the countrywide average. $30,000, and you're 21 or 22, you're in your young 20s, and you owe that much money. And so then people are unable to take jobs that for which their heart sings, you know, that they're really suited for, that feel like it has meaning, for a gift that they want to give and be able to earn a living with it. They have to go where the money is in the corporations, and whether it's lawyers or other professions, they need to do something where the money is. So that leaves a whole lot of dreams unfulfilled on the part of the students and a whole lot of benefit that would be coming to the state and to the whole country.
Yeah, I think it's part of dumbing down the population. I mean, they don't want an educated population. They don't want a population that has time to think for itself. Mm-hmm. They want you to be working at a mindless job all day or something that's, you know, not inherently meaningful and not to be working on changing the system. And they want you to come home so exhausted that all you can do is turn on the TV and have a beer or whatever and then get up for the next day or do the laundry and get your kids ready for school and all those things that multitasking that people have to do.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that there are a lot of different ways to phrase it, but it, in a way, you know, it's killing people's spirit, you know, in our very humanity.
Yeah, but I think there is grounds for hope. I mean, I keep feeling that I want to feel hopeful, partly because of the Internet. So the major media don't have control anymore. We have a way of finding out what's really going on. I don't know that there's any hope for third-party candidates. I mean, my experience being a third-party candidate is that they've done virtually everything to shut us out. In fact, I'll let you speak to that because you have more experience than I do with it.
Well, I got arrested outside of a debate, and that was in 2010 when I ran for governor. And I thought that, I mean, metal handcuffs, dip the head, you know, back of the squad car, the whole thing. Dangerous person. I might bring up a state bank, you know, if I were in the debate, but just trying to be in the audience and got arrested. And the charge that was perfect was trespassing at a private party.
Wow.
That sort of says it all. Yeah, and then L.A. Times calls, and you know, I remember this one time particular, L.A. Times called. I go, oh, good, call them right back, and they gave me their advertising rates. You know, and they have sometimes the last paragraph will list the also-rans, you know, and they're just concentrated on the what I've started calling the Titanic parties because they're heading straight for the iceberg and the leaders are not turning aside. Even sometimes the public station, like we have NPR KQED here in the Bay Area, they do the same thing. Reduce the amount of time that they give the candidates that have something to say and just concentrate on the ones that have the money. And one time I was in a debate on KQED, and it was the first time, and so they had all the candidates all together. They've shut it down every single time it's less than that. Then they had the third-party candidates together and the Titanics, you know, separately in a half hour, you know, just a way of segregating it. But in this first one, I was a little bit intimidated because I thought that it was an eBay millionaire who was running for controller. And I thought, oh, he's got all this research, he's, you know, all this money, he can have all that. All they talked about was who endorsed them and how much money they raised. And so when you talk about dumbing down the voters, you know, and then they'll talk about little, like, stupid things that the candidates have said about each other and stuff. And it's just not at all getting to what will help ourselves, our seniors, our young people, our environment, things like that. It's horrific, and people are smart enough to know it. What I hope people are smart enough to do, however, is to use every bit of power that we have and vote in the primaries, especially here in California with the top two, and vote for people that don't take corporate money. Greens never do, and there are some others that don't take corporate money also. If you don't want a corporate-controlled government, which means a super rich controlled government, if you don't want that, don't vote for their candidate.
So right. Our fearless groundbreaker at the moment is Gail McLaughlin, who's the mayor of Richmond, California, and she's doing remarkable things. I mean, first she stood up to Chevron. She's a Green. Stood up to Chevron, which dominates their city, and got a big tax rebate from them, or a tax settlement of some sort from them. And now she's standing up to the big banks and threatening. I think they need one more vote, but they're threatening to take mortgages by eminent domain, the underwater mortgages, and refinance them for the benefit of the homeowners. So she can do all that because she didn't take corporate money, and she's got the voice to stand up. You probably know her story.
Oh, well, it is. I love the city of Richmond is in the just north a city or two north of Berkeley, and I live in Oakland, so it's real close to me as well. Richmond, California, is the largest city in the country that has a Green Party mayor, and it's one of the things that gives me hope about this too is that Gail ran with other people who all pledged to take no corporate money. Some were green, some are not green, some are Democrats, some are independent, you know, whatever, no party. But they pledged to take no corporate money, and this is in a town with Chevron refineries. Richmond is totally dominated by the biggest corporation in California, which is Chevron. And they never actually had a majority on the city council, and yet they've gotten so many things done. It's like you just need to have somebody at the table to bring these things up. And that's one of the things that they've said, is that because they were able to bring it up, usually they just shut out the good ideas completely. But because these were able to be brought up, in some cases, they actually sort of shamed some of the other folks into supporting it. You know, some of the other city council members, they wouldn't have come up with it themselves, but they were like, oh, my God, you know, here it is. It's out in the open. I guess we've got to support it. And, you know, they'd make their amends, I guess, with Chevron. But that is true. You know, that's a piece of hope right there.
Yeah, that's like European countries that have third parties that actually manage to get some candidates in there and have a voice. You know, they have, I don't remember what you call that form of government.
Proportional representation.
Right, yeah.
And parliamentary.
But we absolutely don't. We have really a one-party system. Who, I think it was in a movie, I've forgotten it. Warren Beatty was in a movie where he said something like, we don't need a three-party system, we need a two-party system.
Right, we need a second party.
So yeah. We need a second party, yeah.
Yeah, just a note about that. Proportional representation, more than 80 countries in the world use it. And in the United States, we've been kept ignorant about what it even is. But it's a system where you have like multi-seat districts. You have 5 seats so that if your party, what you really want, gets 20% of the votes, they will get a seat in the legislature. They'll have a seat at the table. And you can see immediately how that would mean that there would be Greens, there would be Libertarians, and you'd be able to get people voted out so much more easily when it's a 5-person district as opposed to once you're the incumbent, you keep getting reelected. But proportional representation, it sounds so complicated. How come 80 other countries can figure it out and they've kept us ignorant of it?
Mm-hmm. I was reading about the Chinese system, which we think they're totalitarian one-party system, the communist system. But in fact, it sounded not so bad because although it's one party, the people actually compete on the basis of being the best person for the job. So they actually have to show that, you know, what their policy is and how they're going to fix things or, what, you know, they have to show their skills. And so the more skilled people get elected. So they're really running against each other in terms of qualifications, and they're not running against another party. I think our parties are actually very limiting in the sense that, you know, it's all about which party has the most money and can get the most advertising done, instead of about the actual ideas, where it seems, sounds like in China, maybe it is about the ideas.
Right, and they're accountable. And if they don't follow through, they can get kicked out. They have the kind of system where they will lose. Mm-hmm. We've got this kind of system that once they get in, they're virtually guaranteed to get in again.
So I know you know more than I do about the California ins and outs of politics in the last, like, 30 years or so. I was actually out of the country for 11 years. It was kind of came back here as a fool's rush in, pretty much. I mean, I was pretty ignorant about politics. So can you explain, like, all about Prop 13 and what that did to the economy and how things aren't as they seem and that Jerry Brown supposedly has balanced the budget and everybody's cheering what a great job he's done fiscally, but things are really in a sorry state other than that. We have the highest poverty rate in the country.
Right. And the biggest increase in super rich individuals. The California Budget Project updates every year this particular statistic to show who pays taxes. That's what they call it, who pays taxes in California. And the lowest 20% of family income earners pays 10.6% in state and local taxes. So that's 10.6. If you look at the richest 1% of family income, you got to go down. In state and local taxes, they pay 8.8%. So they've got lots more money, and they pay less of each dollar to the state and local taxes than people who have very little money, an average of $13,000. And so you want to have money for rainy days? Tax people the way they used to be taxed. And one of the big things, Proposition 13, is like the star of the show, and it's a villain is the main character. And it came about in 1978, so that's, 36 years ago. It was an initiative that was approved by the voters. It started a tax revolt across the country, and a lot of people credit Ronald Reagan for giving the concentration of wealth and power a big boost and for sort of spurring on the inequality of wealth and power being so much in favor of business rather than people and all of that, and lowering taxes. No, it started in California in 1978. Reagan wasn't elected president until 1980. Jerry Brown was governor for the first time then, but he'd been governor for 3 years, and people were losing their homes that because property taxes was going from $1,000 one year to $2,000 the next year to within a few years it would go up to $5,000 a year, and this was 36 years ago, and the governments were stonewalling the people. Jerry Brown on down, doing nothing about it until finally Howard Jarvis came up with this Prop 13. Howard Jarvis was a landlord, you know, had commercial property, knew exactly that it would help him. And so they voted for it in order to get some relief. They didn't care. You know, at that point, they just needed to have some help. So anytime I talk about Prop 13 in California, I mean, people cross their hearts and, you know, hold their hand to their hearts and say, I love Prop 13. It kept me in my home. We could keep people in their homes a whole lot better than we've been doing. We can keep the good parts of Prop 13 and fix the bad parts. People have been sold a bill of goods that we have to keep the whole thing or else it'll go back to the bad old days of when Jerry Brown was governor the first time, and nobody wants that. You can keep the good, but here's what it's done, is that it used to be that the homeowners paid in total, when you look at property taxes, the homeowners paid a smaller portion than the corporate and commercial taxes, corporate and commercial properties. And now that's reversed. Now the homeowners in total pay more than the corporate and commercial properties. And that's because they flattened the property taxes back to a couple of years prior, and they only allow it to go up a couple of percent a year. And you reassess the property when it changes hands, so when it gets sold. And there are all sorts of loopholes that keep places like Disneyland and, you know, Chevron properties and all of these corporate and commercial properties don't end up having their property taxes increased, whereas when a house
Good
is
point.
Sold.
Disneyland never moves.
Yeah, right. And who gets hit by that? You know, which homeowners end up paying more property taxes? The young people. You know, just exactly the people
right.
who are the
They're
ones
the
that are coming
buyers.
Out of school with yeah. no money. And the grandparents that may be living next door to them and paying a lot less property tax don't want that to happen to their kids. There are solutions. But I want to say that that's one part, the property tax. And in the whole country, a whole lot of people would look at California, and we should be in great shape. If people are in the mode of blaming the Republicans for being pro-rich people, whereas the Democrats are pro-regular people, if people have that idea, then they would think that this state, being a Democratic state, would be in terrific shape. They wouldn't think we'd have the highest poverty rate, and they wouldn't think that we'd have the highest super rich individuals. But they would be
fourth
wrong.
Fourth highest unemployment rate.
Yeah, and the tuition terrible, and the schools with the lowest
very
per
crowded
pupil
schools too.
Crowded schools.
They've laid off thousands of teachers. Yeah.
And what we've got is 100% of the statewide offices, with governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, treasurer, controller, public insurance commissioner, and attorney general, 100% of them are Democrats, and 2/3 majority in both houses of the legislature. And why that's significant is because Prop 13 in 1978, among all the verbiage about property tax, also had a one-liner that in order to increase revenue, both houses of the legislature had to pass the revenue-increasing bills by 2/3 supermajority. Didn't say anything about what you needed to lower it. That just stayed the same, a simple majority. So you get 50%, and people want to please the political donor class, so they lower their taxes. And then you really need it, you can't get it back without 2/3 of a vote. Well, guess what? The legislature in California has had the 2/3 majority for the past couple of years. They didn't do one thing, not one thing, not a single thing.
Now they've lost it again, right? Because it's scandal.
And then they've had some people that have lost, some Democratic legislators that have lost their seats due to criminal behavior. And so they've lost their 2/3 majority, and now they have an excuse again. But for that time, the year or two that they had no excuse, they also did absolutely nothing.
That could explain why Jerry Brown is more fiscally conservative than his own party. I mean, he's fighting his own party on this constitutional amendment. They want to use it for education, which desperately needs it. But I suppose he's looking to get some votes from the Republicans to get his vote on that. But now we, of course, we have a better idea, a way that you could have your cake and eat it too. You could still have your rainy day fund. Well, by having your own bank, you can basically, you have a credit line with your bank, and therefore you don't need a rainy day fund. When North Dakota, the only state with its own bank, went over budget a number of years ago, they tapped up their credit line with the Bank of North Dakota, and the next year they were right back on track. They didn't go heavily into debt. They weren't beholden to Wall Street. They didn't have to jump it through any hoops, no interest rate swaps, no bid rigging, no none of those things that we get caught up in from our Wall Street dealings, because they have their own banking system, which is basically a credit system. So they have their own system of credit, and it doesn't cost them an arm and a leg for the credit itself. So that's why we're pushing the state-owned bank idea. We can fix our problems, and we can have it both ways. In other words, we can still have the money to spend as needed, and we can have a huge credit machine that will allow the state and local governments to have credit lines with their own state-owned bank in the event of emergency. So Clint Richardson actually looked carefully at the California Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, and he found that there were $600 billion in funds, you know, surplus funds all over the state. So that's money that can't be spent. It's all earmarked for whatever it's for, like highway fund or something. But it's just sitting there. I mean, they all have this mentality that you have to save your money just in case of a catastrophe. Why? Because they don't have a cheap credit line. Banks don't do that because they do have a cheap credit line with other banks. And in North Dakota, they have a cheap credit line with their own banks. So that's the solution to that, is we need to have our own bank.
Exactly. And so it's one of those, you know, pieces of garbage wrapped up like a birthday present, the rainy day fund. And it's sort of that people think about it. It's very hard not to think about the state budget in the same way that you think about the money in your wallet or your checkbook, you know, and you think, oh, well, I better do some savings and stuff like that. But we don't have this $6 billion of surplus earmarked, you know, money sitting there in the bank, you know. So then he can pull this over on people, call it a rainy day fund, and meanwhile, it serves to concentrate wealth and power, to take it away from the people who need it, to put it in a fund and have it, you know, investors and have it sit there rather than be used, as you're saying, with a publicly owned bank.
Mm-hmm. And this gets pretty complicated, but what do they do with those bonds? So let's say they buy some government securities, and that's what it's invested in, and they're sitting in some big Wall Street bank. Well, the big Wall Street bank uses that collateral for the repo market for their own speculation. I mean, the bonds are still there. It's the same deal where they say, well, we didn't spend the bonds. We just pledged them in the repo market. But it's the nature of that whole market that I've written about the super priority in bankruptcy. The derivatives have super priority. They get to go first because they're guaranteed by this collateral. But where did the collateral come from? It's that same collateral that got posted supposedly to protect the deposits of the state and local governments. They're the secured deposits. It's the security for these deposits. You know, these bonds may only be paying us a teeny amount, but the banks are using them for their own speculative purposes and making out like bandits, literally. And, of course, the more money they make, the more risky it is. And our money is in these risky banks, and we think it's all protected because it's supposedly securitized.
Right. And Jerry Brown, it was September of 2011, I think, when he vetoed a study for a public bank. The legislature of California actually passed a bill to set up a task force to study the idea of a publicly owned state bank, put it on Jerry Brown's desk, and he vetoed it. And he said, "Well, I'm for saving money. You know, we don't need to set up an expensive blue ribbon task force. This should be studied by the Banking Commission." Well, gee, I wonder what they would come up with. Well, we know what they came up with: nothing.
Right. They didn't even look at it. That's the thing. They never discussed it. And the thing about a blue ribbon committee is that you get to have hearings, you get to put your people on, and you get a report, a written report. So where is this written report that the Banking Commission was going to do and save us a lot of money? If we don't have a written report, we've got nothing. And, yeah, you know, they've never had a hearing on it even.
That's like the blue ribbon task force. It's like puts it on the table. You know, it's just like up in the city of Richmond. You've got they've got 2-3 people at the table, and even if it's 8 people around it and they're not a majority, they're bringing that stuff up. You know, the public banking task force would bring it up.
And so it might make the news, and people might get excited.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things that, as you know, I mentioned Rosie the Riveter team before, and actually Richmond has a Rosie the Riveter museum and park and stuff. I guess that's where that came from. She was working for the in the factories during the war effort.
Really?
But let's do it for good things like a good environment and education and economy and parks and things like that. But I think of us as the Rosie the Riveter team will roll up our sleeves and take care of the economy and the budget and the money here in California, and not sold out to any corporations, no corporate campaign contributions. We just need somebody that's not a Democrat/Republican and don't have to toe their line.
Yeah, and on that constitutional amendment, I mean, he's making it part of the Constitution. So that means they have to do it year after year. Even, like you say, you can't reverse this stuff easily. Apparently, Jerry Brown's saying, well, things look like they're okay now, but we will have another recession. Or, you know, it's inevitable. The banks are going to go down again. I mean, I don't think that's what he said. What he meant was that we're going to run out of this. They temporarily raise the sales taxes, and when that runs out, we'll have a budget problem again. And so they're saving up for that. But that just means they're chipping away from the taxpayers' money. Mm-hmm. But they won't, in other words, they won't really not have that tax increase. They'll just keep it'll always be there because those extra taxes will go for it. Anyway.
But rather than making it permanent, Jerry Brown is the one who made it temporary, which means that people have to fight for this. I'm talking about the tax increase that happened in November of 2012. Actually, Jerry Brown had proposed an initiative and there was a different initiative called the Millionaire's Tax. Polls showed that people preferred the Millionaire's Tax. It had higher tax rates on the rich. People have started to realize that, in fact, it is unfair, and, in fact, it's set up so that they won't have the opportunity to become millionaires themselves if we keep doing things this way. So don't blame people for being too stupid about it, you know?
Yeah, I think people are also realizing that profits don't trickle down from the rich. I mean, the argument's always been that you've got to keep the corporations free to make money, and you've got to keep the rich free to make money because they'll then hire the other people. But they don't. They squirrel that money away in offshore tax havens where it's just a drain on the system. It's money making more money, sucking more money out of the system. So it's just this great big parasite that's these numbers that run up on a counter. And the numbers are sucking numbers out of our system, but they're not doing anything productive for our system. Another really interesting debate that's going on in England right now is about, the Bank of England came out with this directive saying that, contrary to popular belief, banks don't really lend their depositors money. They actually create that money on their books. So then Martin Wolf wrote a thing saying that, in that case, we shouldn't be allowing private banks to do this. We should be that should be a government function. So they had this big debate going on whether all the money should be issued by the government. But the trouble with that, of course, is you actually need banks to create credit. I mean, credit is where all our money comes from, and we need the credit. So Richard Werner, who's a professor in England, pointed to the German and Asian systems where they have credit guidance. So you let the banks create money only for productive purposes. I mean, they do allow them to make credit, but you guide what the credit goes for. So you can't create credit just for speculative purposes that basically are a pyramid scheme where you're making money off of money without actually making any products. So there are some really interesting theories out there or things going on about ideologically about how we could change the system, but how we'll ever pull that off politically, it just seems so overwhelming. Just my small experience here with running for office just makes me see that it's absolutely impossible. I mean, it's, an uphill battle at best, but I mean, no matter how fast you run uphill, I just don't think it can be done.
I'll say one thing about that, and that is that they are not, they being the people who for whatever warped reason, whatever misguided reason, want to concentrate all the power and money in their own hands. They are not going to change things to make it easier. And so we have to find a way to find opportunities within the rules that they have created. They're not going to make the rules better. You know, we can lobby about it every once in a while. They'll give us a half measure. But a perfect example of what I'm talking about is this top two primary in California, which they actually, it was in the state of Washington. There's something like it in Louisiana and in California. They tried to do it in Arizona. They wanted to spread it across the country, but Arizona rejected it. Thank goodness. But it's top two primary, which means that in June, any voter can vote for any candidate, but only two candidates will go to the November election. Whereas it used to be that one candidate from each party would go to the November election, so there might be six candidates in November, and now there's just going to be two. And historically, that has meant incumbents and highly funded candidates. However, the opportunity is here. Any voter can vote for any party. So don't vote for candidates from that take corporate money or who are running with political parties that take corporate money, which virtually means don't vote for any Democrats and Republicans. There are a couple of exceptions, and you'll, you know, be able to find that out from their ballot statement. But vote for Greens, vote for peace and freedom, vote for people who do not take corporate money. Give us a chance to have a government that's not run by corporations. So that's what I mean by there's an opportunity to do that. But people have to be courageous to jump off the Titanic before it crashes into the iceberg. You know? And for some reason that seems a little riskier than staying on that big boat, you know?
Or I think they're just not aware, and we don't have a chance to get to make them aware, because we don't have the money to do advertising. I've noticed that I actually have a lot of supporters, but in a lot of places that I always post articles, but they're 501c3s, so they're not allowed to support candidates. So I actually find that I have less of a voice, and I'm less able to talk about things that I would, for example, do as treasurer, because I'm a candidate. So I can't post on those 501c3 outlets. And our own group, Public Banking Institute, is a 501c3, so they're not allowed to support candidates. I attended a thing a couple of days ago where they actually named me, and that it was a UCLA, and it was a KPFK thing about community banking. And they had two experts on, and somebody asked Ian Masters, who hosted it, why he didn't ask me. And Ian Masters said, well, she was the first person I thought of, but she's running for political office, so we can't have her without having all the other candidates. And then he actually, in his presentation in the beginning, he said, I understand Ellen Brown's in the audience. So, you know, they actually are supportive, but they can't support because of this rule. Supposed to support us, but it actually hurts us. I mean, I think the rule is allegedly there so that we'll get a voice when they have the big candidates on, but what happens is we don't get a voice at all.
No, and they keep shifting what it takes in order to be in the debates, just in order to shut people out. Because the 1% in their corporations find it very easy to control the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They can give a small amount of their total profits and buy the legislature, and you know, buy and give it to the corporations and buy their allegiance. It's actually pretty low cost investment, given the subsidies and the preferential treatment and the loopholes and law changes and stuff like that they get in return. It's an incredibly powerful investment to buy politicians. But what those people could do, I mean, and we just need to look for every possible opportunity, but the people in the panel that you were talking about, is go ahead and invite the other two candidates that are running for state controller. Invite them and Ellen Brown and see who comes and talks about public banking. And what if they all came? Terrific. You know, then that's all the better. You know, so they'd win either way. They'd be able to have you there because they had invited the others, or they'd have everybody there, and it would be a forum with the elected officials who would have some power to advocate for, push, implement a public bank. And so it's like sometimes there are pieces of power that we have, whether it's voters or people that are creating the panels or whatever, that we're not even using. And it's just our job to look for all of those in every which way we can, you know, in addition to the individual choices of the wallet power that, you know, we can send toward Coca-Cola or we can not send it toward Coca-Cola. You know, we can go the individual restaurant or the chain restaurant, you know. But that's the thing that I, again, I know if we had the advertising, if we had the money to do the advertising, we could do sort of almost the anti-ad, you know, and say, vote for, go for all these things that aren't spending the big bucks. You know, that's where you'll get the value for your money.
Mm-hmm. I think we're drawing too near the end, but I just wanted to ask, I think most people don't even probably know what a controller is. I don't think I knew until I, you know, became involved. And so between us as controller and treasurer, we might say how we think we can bring about this state-owned bank or what we would do about it. I know as treasurer, what's interesting to me is the treasurer manages this treasurer investment pool, which currently has $59 billion in it, the last time I looked, and the interest rate that it's earning is 0.26%. So it's making almost nothing. It's money that can't be, again, it's rainy day funds, basically all these surplus funds that are all collected into a pool managed by the treasurer. But it can't be spent because it's earmarked for whoever's fund it was. Like Orange County doesn't want LA County getting their money or whatever. They want to keep it in Orange County. But it can be invested. So you could take some of that money, invest it as stock in a state-owned bank, The Bank of North Dakota has a return on investment of between 17 and 26% in the last, ever since 2008, which is when everybody else has done extremely poorly. So they're just doing brilliantly well. I mean, it's a really good, safe, sound investment to invest in your own state-owned bank, assuming, of course, you set it up right so that you're not going to, I mean, I know some banks do go bankrupt, but you don't want to set it up as that sort of bank. You want it to be conservatively run and run for the benefit of the state. And so, and what does the controller then do that...
Well, I'll say, I also want to say North Dakota proves a state can do it. Lots of countries have publicly owned central banks, and so so you can scale it up and run it right. What the controller does is it's essentially the bookkeeper, the state's bookkeeper. What money's coming in, what money's going out, it deals with collecting the revenues and the taxes and making the disbursements, paying payroll and all of that stuff, and as well as financial audits. And the first order of business, work on setting up a public bank. Second order of business, audit Prop 13 so that people understand the long-term negative effects as well as the positive effects of Prop 13 since 1978. And both the treasurer and the controller are on literally dozens of commissions having to do with finances and taxes and banking and all of that. And so we are a voice at the table, or two voices at the table, finding every way, every avenue to shift from the private concentration of wealth and power to the public accessibility, you know, to public wealth and power, the commonwealth of the state. And so by being at the table in those commissions, literally dozens, I think there's something like 40, that's where the work would be done toward creating a much more fair economy using public banking and fair taxes and all the other means.
And besides that, we would be independently elected. We're not staff, so it can be an independent voice. Well, that's great, Laura. It's great talking to you, and it actually encourages me and makes me more enthusiastic, even though we do have an uphill battle. It's great to have, you know, fellow team workers. So it's great talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck in your
race. Well, thank you, Ellen. Thank you for all you do and all you've done.
On today's Public Banking Report, we speak with Lauren Steiner about efforts getting underway to organize citizen support for creation of a new public bank for the city of Los Angeles.
Welcome, Lauren.
Hi, Walt.
You are just getting started, and of interest was that a recent newspaper article pointed out that Los Angeles has been spending more money on Wall Street fees and costs than they spend on repairing their street, you know, fixing Wall Street and not fixing the streets of Los Angeles. Did that have a lot of resonance in the public, in your experience?
Well, I can't say that it did, because certainly wasn't covered in the LA Times. Those types of reports are never covered on TV news. So I can't say that it did resonate with the public. As far as opinion leaders, it's hard to say, but the general public, I would say no.
So what brought you into this initiative?
Well, you know, I've been a political activist most of my life. I got back into it after having a career and raising young children, I would say about 10 years ago, and then it was more through electoral politics, and after a few years of realizing that that was going nowhere, I started getting more involved with issues, and specifically environmental issues. But the Occupy movement in the fall of 2011 really resonated with me, and it became clear that getting money out of politics and environmental issues, that they were all very connected, and that it was really a matter of the 1% controlling our economy and our politics. So that meme of the 99% versus the 1% really resonated with me. And I heard Ellen Brown speak at a conference I organized in November of 2011 about public banking. And it really was clear to me that it was an issue of economic democracy. So I had, about the same time, friended John Chang, who is our state's controller, on Facebook. I had met him at a couple of political fundraisers and sent him a private message about the public bank as a solution to some of California's problems. And to my surprise, he responded to me, and I started having a correspondence with our state controller over Facebook. But he was skeptical about where the money would come from and how the bank would perform as far as the rate of return. And it wasn't until about a year later that I got some interest out of him when I pointed out that the CalPERS and the CalSTRS pension funds only received a 1.8 rate of return on their investment, whereas the Bank of North Dakota received an 18% return, and that was a down year for them. So he got interested, and about a year ago, Mark Armstrong and I had set up a meeting with some county officials and community banking representatives to talk about establishing a county bank. I went to the public banking conference last summer, got even more information, got even more excited about it, and this spring I took a course at Harvard at the Kennedy School of Government to develop my leadership abilities, because I've been running a lot of rallies and campaigns, and really I'm just trying to make myself a more effective organizer, and we needed a project for the class, and I was going to do a fracking project, but the Los Angeles fracking moratorium ordinance was approved really quickly. So in week two, I was left without a project, and I said, why don't I try to develop a leadership team for establishing a public bank in the city of L.A.? Because by this point, Eric Garcetti, who I know a little bit, got elected mayor, and I have a very good working relationship with two very progressive councilmen. So I thought, you know what, my ties are better with the city, so why don't we shift this over? And I looked around for a week or so to try to develop a leadership team. And, of course, Ellen Brown, who is the, you know, mother of the public banking movement, was natural to be on the team because she lives in Los Angeles. And then I got Bill Pruzlecki, who is with an organization called Power, People Organized for West Side Renewal. They were one of the organizations that sponsored that report you spoke about. Rick Latham, who's a former union organizer, a friend of mine from the Occupy movement, Daniel Lee, who is the organizer for Move to Amend, which is trying to get a constitutional amendment to say that money is not speech and corporations are not people, and Alberta Pedroia, who also is interested in public banking. So we have had one meeting of our leadership team already where we're plotting out our campaign, and we're very excited about it.
It really sounds terrific. You've got a tremendous amount of energy and expertise available to you, and the connections that you've got politically are extremely important in terms of moving some sort of an agenda with the city. I'm really impressed to hear that, Lauren. Congratulations on that.
Eric Garcetti is very responsive. He likes to have a lot of listening sessions, and he had a listening session for his budgeting process. And I went to that, and the person who was speaking about his budget, his deputy mayor for budget and innovation, his name is Rick Cole, and after he made his remarks, which basically consisted of how much the budget is strapped and so many things that we, the people, want to have funded, we can't fund because of pension liabilities and things of that nature, I went up to him afterwards and gave him the elevator speech about the public bank and said, certainly you must be paying a lot of money in interest and fees to Wall Street. Imagine if you could free that up, what other things you could be funding. And he was really interested. He said to me, yes, we're spending about $600 million a year in interest. And if you combine that with the $200 million that report showed they're paying in fees, that's a large chunk of change. You know, he knew about the public bank. And he said that was part of the populist movement. You're really going to need a real movement to get this going in L.A. because, as you can imagine, the resistance is going to be great. And I said, well, that's where I come in, you know. I don't know that much about banking and finance. I'm trying to get other people on the team to handle that. But he directed me to the city council. He suggested that if it came from them, then it might have more resonance. And I had already thought of that approach.
You've got the strategic approach that makes a lot of sense. But creating the populist awareness and the environment in which these political leaders can actually take a stand and not get knocked down is really very, very important. So congratulations on such a terrific beginning, Lauren. And it's very exciting to know that Los Angeles is really going to be on the map in the discussion with other major cities starting to consider this as an option.
I would like to say to your listeners that if there is any people in Los Angeles who are connected with constituencies, organizations, neighborhood groups, professional societies, anyone who you think might benefit from a public bank, which could really be anyone, I would appreciate being contacted because we do need to build a lot of popular support, and that's going to be the bulk of our time. People can feel free to email me at Lauren Steiner, that's LaurenSteiner57 at gmail.com.
Thank you so much for your time today, and we'll look forward to see how the public banking movement in Los Angeles develops from here.
That was Lauren Steiner in Los Angeles. And that will do it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. You can listen to podcasts of this show by visiting prn.fm, and you can read Ellen's latest work by visiting ellenbrown.com. For information on public banking, go to publicbankinginstitute.org. Our thanks to Wallaby Studios in Philadelphia, and on behalf of Ellen Brown, I'm Walter Cree. Thanks to you for listening. Money!